Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable, the place where Christians and non-Christians get together for dialogue and debate, conversations that matter every week here on Premier Christian Radio on a Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored and listen to around the world via our podcast. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is the place to go to get hold of the latest shows, to subscribe to the podcast, to see all the other resources and good stuff. And it's a great joy to be able to bring you on this week's special edition of the programme, highlights from Unbelievable the Conference 2018, which took place last week in central London. Myself and about 600 friends joined together to hear from some brilliant speakers from around the world in partnership with Reasons to Believe, our conference partners. And all happening, of course, on the same day as another little event took place in Windsor Castle, a royal wedding between Harry and Meghan. We did actually catch some of that as well in a side room. Some of us were gathered around as the ceremony was taking place, and along with about 1.9 billion other people, I think, around the world. Didn't quite have that many to the conference, but we were pleased to hold up our own end against the competition from the royal wedding. I wonder whether you what you thought of the royal wedding, though, and did you catch that sermon from Bishop Michael Curry? Of quite a passionate delivery, wasn't there? But a sermon that caused different reactions from the Christian community. In fact, we've got some blogs on that subject on the Premier Christianity blog. You want to go and check some of the reactions to that. But it was really wonderful to be there on the day. So many great speakers, so many great people that I met who had, many of whom had flown in from all over the world, actually, for this year's conference. Lots of show listeners got to sign books for a number of different people as well who bought copies of Unbelievable, the book. And we had a big announcement to make about our big conversation series. Put out a special little podcast explaining that, announcing that this last week. But if you haven't yet listened to that or seen the promo video, can I encourage you to go onto the Unbelievable Facebook page and check it out there? It's pinned to the top of the Unbelievable Facebook page, or indeed go to the Twitter account, or simply go to the website of the big conversation to find out what it's all about, what these shows are going to be, who's going to be involved, and watch the video promo. That's at thebigconversation.show. And while you're there, sign up to the brand new Unbelievable newsletter, which will give you first dibs on those shows, exclusive content, and loads of other great stuff as well. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, as we hear highlights from last week's conference, you're going to hear highlights from Glenn Scrivener, Rob Parsons, Hugh Ross, Sharon Dirks, Ruth Jackson, Andy Bannister, Ken Samples, and Fuzz Rana, and some selected excerpts from the end of the day Q&A as well. If you couldn't be there, don't worry. You can pre-order the DVD and MP3 CD containing every single seminar from the day, or indeed pre-order the digital download. The place to go in order to do that right now is premier.org.uk/shop. That's the place to go in order to pre-order this year's conference on DVD and MP3 CD, or to pre-order the digital download. premier.org.uk/shop. Well, early on, opening up the conference, we heard the poetic skills of evangelist Glenn Scrivener with a spoken word piece called Given. Here's Glenn.
I wrote a poem just for you guys, just for this week, and it's based on a conversation I had with a guy after a talk that I gave at a very posh university. A very posh student came up to me afterwards, and I think he was outraged that I was Australian and yet allowed to speak on his turf. And we had a conversation that unfolded pretty much the way that this poem unfolds, except that I didn't get the chance to say the last stanza to him, and none of it rhymed. But apart from that, pretty much the same. It's called Given. 19 years old, a quiff golden, enfolding spectacled incredulity. He flew at me like a hawk at the end of my talk, all jovial, amused a colonial like me could dare to be serious. His tone imperious, he dismissed the mysterious with a sigh. "We cannot take truth from on high," he cried. "We must build our beliefs from below." I said, "Oh, how do you know?" He said, "Surely you think that is so," he said, now cynical. "We cannot rest on a miracle. Our method is empirical." I said, "I admire your modus operandi. I myself find it quite handy in matters scientific. But let's be specific. Which specific item within this world has told you how to view it? Or did you just intuit your scheme?" He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You claim to be earthbound, to build your world up from the ground. But where is that approach found? You can't extract it from any brute fact. It's not as though nature is a philosophy tract. I'm not trying to be satirical, but you need a reason to be empirical." He said, "It's just a given. A given." This became the pattern of our parlay. Whatever moves he'd put in play, I'd find beneath the display a stray assumption, a hidden reliance. Like when he spoke of science, I rhapsodized about its cause, to hypothesize our higher laws, to scrutinize their intercourse, to crystallize their basic force, prognosticize their future course. It's an enterprise I full endorse. But tell me, what lies at its source? To make it work, you need triangulation, law and mind and world's relation, interlocking calibration, a miracle of integration. Look around, it should astound this scientific playground. Why should such a world be found? Who do we need to reimburse for this rationally ordered universe? It's a given, he said. He seemed to really like this answer. Whenever he'd advance a theory, underneath I saw it clearly. Like when we spoke of human rights, I asked how apes attained such heights. It's a given, I was told. And when he scolded Old Testament wars, I asked, whence came supracultural mores? What's the source of timeless laws? He'd pause and then say, it's a given. Which was frustrating. But I'd continue unabating, asking, who are we, these minds relating? How is brain chemistry debating? If we're synapses pulsating, who's the me that's cogitating? It's a given, he said. He thought the mystery of mind should be disenchanted. I reckoned he just took it for granted, which seems a fudge. But our conversation nudged along, discussing values by which we judge, maths, morals, reason, the cosmos's cohesion, goodness, truth, beauty, love, the fact we hold such things above. All givens, he croaked. I broke and said, this world is bespoke, your mind is woke, each moment transcendent values you invoke. Is this a joke? Because it's ill-delivered. You admit it's all given. Ever wonder about the giver? Because while we're taking everything for granted, supplanting his fame, branding it all in our name, he has planted himself here all the same. In a world that just takes, he breaks himself open in pure devotion. Himself he outpours to prove he's the source. My friend, I said, we have common cause. It is all given. And he's given. So he can be yours. Thanks.
That's fantastic.
That was Glenn Scrivener. And look out for that spoken word video coming out online soon. We're going to release that up on the Unbelievable Facebook page and Twitter account and on our all-new YouTube channel as well for Unbelievable. Look out for that. Also opening up the conference this year was the wonderful Welshman Rob Parsons of Care for the Family. First time he's been at Unbelievable, the conference, delivering a more of a pastoral dimension to some of the seminars he was involved in. This was his opening address titled Beyond Answers, Keeping the Faith When Life is Tough.
It's a great privilege to be with you. We all know that one of the big questions is why does a good and all-powerful God allow suffering? But in many people's minds, there's a deeper question than that. Why do bad things happen to good people? But for others, there's an even deeper question, and that this stops many coming to faith and knocks some away from following Christ. And the question is this: why do I suffer? It's at the heart of the oldest book of the Bible. Satan comes to God and says, well, of course he loves you. But touch his family, touch his wealth, touch his body. See what happens then. It's as if we begin our Christian lives with the idea that there's a deal. And the deal goes something like this. I will follow you, and I will love you, and you will love me, and you will look after me. And I know there'll be things like influenza and little things and minor hassle, but no big stuff. No kids that get cancer, no marriages that break up, no job redundancies, none of the big stuff. But of course, ladies and gentlemen, there's no deal. I think of a man aged 45 years old. He had an incredible ministry, lovely wife, four great kids, lovely job, beautiful home. 45 years old, served Christ for 25 years. On the day he lost his job, he lost his faith. Why would God do this to me? And down the years, I have seen countless men and women, faithful followers of Jesus, some of them in the area of apologetics. They fought on the issue of the reliability of Scripture, the resurrection of Jesus, the deity of Christ. And what hit them was not logic, but life. Out of a clear blue sky, a child that died, a marriage that failed, a job that was lost. Why would God allow this to happen to me? I've been speaking about this man for some years, and not too long ago I got the chance to speak to him. David Works came out of church one Sunday morning, not too long ago, with his four children. He said, where do you want to go for lunch? Do you fancy Good Times Hamburger Stall? They didn't have to pray about it. It was their favorite restaurant in the whole of the USA. And as they made their way across the car park in that winter's day, he said, we picked our way across the ice puddles and made our way to our white Toyota Sienna people carrier. The Works family have a little tradition that you travel home from a journey in the same seat as you traveled to the destination. And Rachel, his daughter, went to get in the front seat. But Stephanie, her sister, said, no, no, it's my turn. Okay, said Rachel. And Stephanie gets in the front seat, and Rachel's outside the car, and she's looking in her handbag. And David Works said, I remember getting in the car and I stuck my seatbelt in, and as I did, I heard another metallic sound, and I look, and 150 meters away, there's a man dressed all in black and he's got an automatic rifle and he's firing at us. And I scream to my little family, get down! And then I look at Rachel and her coat is blown open. And she's got a white t-shirt on underneath. There's a little red dot and it's growing above her ribcage. And she says, Daddy, I think I've been hit. And I get out of the car to go to her and I get hit in the side. He said, I remember lying on the tarmac and saying to my darling daughter, Rachel, I can't get to you, darling. And he said, I remember saying, that's okay, Daddy. And there are bullets flying around. And I, in my heart, begin having a conversation with God. And I'm saying, what is going on here? We're a missionary family. We're about to go around the world for you. And he said it wasn't audible, but it was as good as if it was audible. I felt God say to me, David, we're not going over this, and we're not going under it, and we're not going around it. We are going through it. Stephanie and Rachel died that day. And David said, I was in the hospital that night and I thought, God, what is going on? How can we possibly lose two of our kids in one day? He said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm with Peter. Where would I go? You alone have the words of eternal life. But this is not Disney World. Of course there's anger. Of course there's rage. But he remembers reading the 23rd Psalm at his daughter's funeral. He remembers 6 months later meeting the parents of the gunman, the young gunman who was shot by a security guard shortly after he attacked the Works family. And they hugged together. They both lost a child. And David Works and his wife had to take the incredible decision. Do you still go on serving a God that doesn't take you over things and round things and under things, but through things? Professor Joad was asked, if you could ask anybody in the world any one question, what would you ask? He said, I would ask Jesus Christ, did you really rise from the dead? It all hangs on that. He said that when he wasn't a Christian. And suddenly Thomas is faced with the risen Christ. You want answers? It doesn't get any better than this. He's faced with the risen Christ. He's got witnesses there. It's not just in his mind. He can smell him. He can see him. He can touch him. Jesus says, go ahead, stick your hand in. In terms of answers, it doesn't get any better than this. And Jesus said, great Thomas, you've seen and believed. Blessed are those that haven't seen and yet believe. Why? Because there's more. Because ultimately the answers themselves will never get you through. What will get you through ultimately, although they are vitally important, of course they are, it's not enough. Somewhere along the line, you're going to have to love and trust anyway. In Care for the Family, we work with parents who have children with special challenges. And some time ago, our people took 60 away. These kids were addicted to illegal drugs. They had eating disorders. Some had emotional or physical challenges. And I joined them on a Saturday night to bring a closing address. I go into a room. There's about 60 people. They've got their backs to me. They're singing a worship song. I've got a message in my pocket I've prepared. And suddenly the woman in front of me bursts into tears and runs out of the room. I chase after her. I say, how can I help you? She said, you're Rob, aren't you? I said, yes. She said, it was kind of you to come after me. How can I help you? She said, I don't think you can. My son's a drug addict. The dealers caught him and set him alight. I begged him not to give evidence in court against them. But he insisted on going, except he didn't turn up at court. And the police came to my home looking for him. And I went searching for him. I found him dead in a squat. Two men were seen running from the house. The police are trying to work out whether he took his life purposely, whether he overdosed accidentally, or whether he was murdered. I think he was murdered. And I pray with her, I comfort her as best I can. And then I go take my seat in the front row, right where you are now, sir. And there's a young woman speaking. She's about 28 years old. She had my husband and I so wanted children. And then I became pregnant. And when my little girl was born, she had Down syndrome. And then shortly afterwards, my husband contracted cancer and he died. My little girl's 6 years old now. And she said, the other day I'm in the garden and I'm praying with a friend from church who's ill. And suddenly my little girl with Down syndrome, she comes out and she sees what's going on. And she puts one hand on my friend's arm and she puts her other hand in the air and she begins to pray. In that lovely voice she has, that God would make my friend well. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm sat there. And the message in my pocket doesn't look anything like as good as when I prepared it. And I think, what on earth can I say to these people? And then it comes to me, and I say, some of you have disabled children, don't you? And they nod. And I say, but you love them anyway, don't you? And they nod again. And I think they thought I was about to say, that's how God loves you. He loves you anyway. But that's not what I said. I said, that's how you love God. You don't love God because everything in the garden's rosy. How you Christians say, God bless my home, he's blessed my church, he's blessed my family. Isn't God good? Yes, don't knock that. But that's not the test. The test is when you say, with an old prophet, though the fig tree doesn't blossom, and there be no fruit on the vine, that the produce of the olive fail, and there's no food in the fields, and there are no sheep in the pen and cattle in the stall, still will I rejoice in you. That's the test, and I'm telling you guys, whatever we believe or don't believe, there will come a time when we're going to have to believe in God beyond answers, important though they are, to hold on to a God that takes us sometimes in his love through things and allows us to go through things. And can you and I love him then, not because of, but in spite of, not just in plenty, but in poverty? Can we love him as he loves us? Can we love him beyond answers? Can we love him anyway? By God's grace, when that day comes, may we be able to. For some of you are going through tough times in your life right now. Your hearts are breaking. Your kids are breaking your heart. Your marriages are going through tough times. And you're almost hanging on to God by your fingertips. I want you to know how precious that love is, because you are loving him against the odds. Don't lose heart. So we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. And our light and momentary trouble is achieving for us a glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen will last forever. God, give us the grace on that day to love him anyway. Bless you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
That was Rob Parsons opening up this year's Unbelievable the Conference, and you're listening to a special highlights edition of the Unbelievable show today. Rob and Catherine Hill from Care for the Family were also both involved in delivering seminars around what to do when loved ones reject faith and how to harness children's tech in a digital age. If you want to catch the rest of their sessions, again, available on the DVD and MP3 CD and digital download. Available to pre-order now from the Premier website, premier.org.uk/shop. There was also a lot of fun to be had on the day during the Unbelievable Conference. I had with me a pair of very garish, flashing light US flag-themed novelty glasses. You'd have to see them to believe them, really. But they were given to me by two lovely listeners, Kara and Wendy, who actually flew in all the way from the USA for this year's conference. And so here's me donning the glasses and finding out just how far and wide people had come for the conference this year.
Unbelievable is listened to all over the world as a podcast. In fact, I brought with me some special glasses that I was given by two USA listeners who, check this out, not just that, come on. This is Wendy and Kira, who actually flew in especially for Unbelievable the Conference this week. There they are. Give us a wave, Wendy and Kira. I know that we also have, obviously, our delegation from Reasons to Believe, who we met earlier in the day. But also, I think we've got people here from Ohio. Can we have a shout from Ohio? Somewhere back there, Ohio is. Kentucky? There we go. Florida? Come on. Sweden and Norway? Yes, there they are. France? Anyone here from France? There we go. And Scotland? Anyone north of the border? There we go. You came all the way down to London. Thank you. And Wales, have we got representatives from Wales? Who's come from what you would call the north? Yes? Thank you. Anyone from the south? Yay! Okay. Well, there's quite a few of us from the south. But it's great to have you. And I'm going to take these glasses off now. It's great, though, that Unbelievable has continued to establish itself actually as a program that's listened to around the world, and not just listened to by Christians, but listened to by atheists and agnostics as well. And we're really excited about something that we're launching in just a few weeks' time, and you are the very first people to hear about it. We're calling it The Big Conversation, and it's a special series of videos featuring some of the world's leading atheist and Christian thinkers discussing some of the biggest questions in life. Here's a little video preview.
Are you saying that no one is really an atheist deep down?
I didn't say no one was. Okay. I said that most of the people who claim to be atheists aren't.
My response is, nothing matters. It's all empty and meaningless. This is how the world is. Get used to it.
The first part of that is nihilistic, and the second part isn't. So how do you reconcile those two things?
But humanism is grounded in our universal humanity. The fact we're made of the same stuff. We're the same species. We all are sentient.
I don't doubt that many, many of my atheist friends are committed to human dignity or human equality. I can't see, as it were, where the deep foundations for that are.
Nature is awash in purposes. They emerge from the bottom up, from a purposeless process. That's the genius of Darwin's idea.
That's a heroic project.
It is.
It is, but I don't think it's a possible one.
Something that makes us connect with that thing that is outside of ourselves. I can't put a name on that or call it God.
That experience of an encounter with the reality of the resurrected Christ was life-changing.
There you go. It's exciting, isn't it? We really have been fortunate. With the help of some funding, we've been able to draw some of the biggest names in the areas of atheism and Christianity on some of the biggest questions. And we're continuing to film this series as well. In fact, we're filming one just in a couple of weeks' time. And there's a special event that we want to tell you about. Now, if you want to engage in the big conversation yourself, for the very first time, we're launching an unbelievable newsletter. And we would love you all to sign up to that newsletter before you leave the building today. Also, a special event as part of the Big Conversation series. On the 18th of July, I'll be hosting a special live audience edition of Unbelievable at a location in London with Professor John Lennox and Professor Michael Roos in conversation on atheism, science, and the evidence for God. So that's the place to go for everything you need to know about that, though, thebigconversation.show. Tell your friends. You're going to be hearing a lot more about it as we go on.
Well, it was a great delight to be able to unveil the Big Conversation at this year's conference. And you can watch that video promo of our forthcoming Big Conversation series on the Unbelievable Facebook page. If you want to check that out, go to facebook.com/unbelievablejb or on our Twitter account at unbelievablejb on Twitter, or indeed on the new Unbelievable YouTube channel. Check that out. That's at youtube.com/premierunbelievable, or simply go to the Big Conversation website. That's at thebigconversation.show, and you can watch the promo there. And make sure while you're there to register to receive our newsletter, all new newsletter. It is GDPR compliant, and if you don't know what that is, then good for you, because every single organization in the whole of the UK has had to do a major kind of a revamp of their mailing list. But if you do go and get the newsletter, register for it, you'll be the first to hear about new episodes of The Big Conversation as they land, exclusive content, and of course our forthcoming app as well, which we're very excited about. And as you heard mentioned there, there's going to be a live edition of Unbelievable as part of this Big Conversation series featuring John Lennox and Michael Roos. You can come along and be part of that show in London on the 18th of July. Go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievablelive to book your place in. Well, we're listening to highlights from Unbelievable Conference 2018 on today's edition of the show. And there's more to come in the next part of today's programme from Sharon Dirks on the issue of suffering. Andy Bannister answers one of the five hard questions you voted for. And Ken Samples talks about Christianity compared to other religions. Come back again for the next part of Unbelievable very soon.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue,
find out how the church reacted to the Grenfell Tower fire in our exclusive interview with Bishop Graham Tomlin. Plus, is hidden disappointment killing the church? We look at how to handle this difficult emotion and discover Christian views on gender and women's ministry in the church. Plus five miraculous stories, news, reviews and more. Out now in the June edition.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of this week's Unbelievable show and podcast. And don't forget that you can email in and tell me what you think about today's show as we listen back to some selected highlights from this year's conference, which took place just a week ago in central London. Some 600 people came down for the day to hear from some brilliant speakers across the Christian spectrum on all kinds of different issues and topics relating to how we share our faith and respond confidently to some of the objections that are out there to Christian faith. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk with your thoughts about today's show. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, and of course on the all-new Unbelievable YouTube channel. Why not go and subscribe to that if you're a YouTube user? youtube.com/premierunbelievable is what you're looking for. All those links and more, of course, available from our show webpage at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, where you can find the podcast, download that, lots of other resources too. And today we're hearing highlights from last week's Unbelievable conference. I wonder, would you like to watch and listen back to it in full? There's 14 hours or more of video and audio available, and you can pre-order the DVD and MP3 CD or the digital download right away of this year's conference. premier.org.uk/shop in order to do that. And so we continue with Sharon Dirks. This is a section of her seminar on finding Christ in a suffering world. And here she is talking about the way that the world is in tension.
You see, even the mechanisms behind some illnesses, they're not bad in themselves. They're in fact life-giving, and they only become a problem, they only lead to disease when they start to go wrong. One example is cancer. I mean, there are so many different types of cancer, but in very, very broad terms, cancer begins when good and life-giving processes within the body start to go wrong. Every human body contains 50 trillion cells. I think I might have said 37 in the last bit, somewhere between 37 and 50. And the role of a cell is to reproduce itself and then die. And cells reproduce through a process known as cell division or mitosis. And roughly every 7 years, all the cells in your body are replaced completely. You are a new person every 7 years. And the older I get, the better this news is. So in a lifetime, roughly 10 to the power of 16 cell divisions will have taken place in your body. And that's about 300 million every minute. So if you didn't think you are busy, you definitely are. And so if this process were to stop, our life would be greatly shortened. The aging process is a slowing down of our body to reproduce new cells. That is what the aging process is. And cancer occurs when this process starts to go wrong. Cells start multiplying out of control, leading to tumours. So cell division is good in and of itself, but cancer arises when this starts to go wrong. And sometimes errors come from outside. They come from the environment, that these things that cause it to go wrong. And sometimes they come from what we inherit from our parents. Sometimes it's something that is passed on to us. And so in a similar way to natural disasters, the mechanisms that lead to disease and sickness are not bad in themselves. They become a problem when they go wrong. And sometimes we are vulnerable to disease through the choices of others. I use an extreme example here. Perhaps you will remember the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, where huge quantities of ionizing radiation were introduced into the Chernobyl community, leading to leukemias and cancers of all sorts in that population as a result of this disaster. They became vulnerable to disease through the choices of others, those that cut corners on making this a secure unit. It's very complex. There are many, many layers involved. Sometimes we're vulnerable through the choices of others. And sometimes we are vulnerable to disease through our own choices. I think we can't deny. Sometimes our bodies are broken, and sometimes it's a reflection of the fact that we are broken and what we put into our bodies. I don't know about you, but I don't always just eat because I'm hungry. There's a brokenness in our relationship to what we put in to our bodies as well. And again, I use an extreme example to make the point, but the movie Super Size Me, has anyone seen it? Where a man called Morgan Spurlock investigated obesity by eating only food from McDonald's for an entire month. Spurlock had to eat three meals a day, eat everything on the McDonald's menu at least once, and when asked if he wanted to supersize his meal order, he had to accept. And in addition, he didn't exercise during this period, and he limited his movements to 5,000 steps a day or less. During the first week, he experienced mood swings, lethargy, and headaches, all of which were alleviated by eating a McDonald's meal. And he began to be described as addicted. After 3 weeks, he had heart palpitations, was informed by his clinician that continuing with the program would put his life at serious risk, And he continued regardless. He gained over 11 kilos and was in significantly worse mental and physical shape by the end. This is an extreme example to make the point that our lifestyle and diet do have an effect on our susceptibility to disease. I think we are responsible in some way for how we look after ourselves, how we steward the bodies that we've been given. And I think the science is showing that exercise, good diet and rest definitely boost the immune system. They increase energy levels. And obviously a lack of those things can have the opposite effect. And I guess some of the most deadly diseases are linked to lifestyle, such as the link between excessive alcohol and liver cirrhosis or lung cancer and smoking. These have been shown to have a high correlation. So sometimes we're vulnerable to disease through our own choices as well. I don't offer that as the only thing out there, but we have to filter it and factor it in as one of the things to consider when we're looking at natural disasters and diseases. So this is all in the big umbrella picture of nature isn't wrong in itself, but our relationship to nature and our relationship to our own bodies perhaps explains some of the suffering that comes as a result. And the second kind of big umbrella position that theologians might hold is to say, no, there is a brokenness to nature as well. And there is a brokenness to the human body as well, because there's still the question of, well, why? Why did I inherit that from my parents? Why must my daughter suffer in this way? And I, you know, the more I think about human suffering, the more I walk through life, I feel like it's incomplete without simply saying, there is something wrong. There's something wrong. There's a brokenness on a global level. And everybody is caught up in it. And this applies to natural disasters and diseases. There is something wrong with the world.
That was Sharon Dirks, and you can hear the rest of her seminar on Finding Christ in a Suffering World. Find out how she reconciles suffering and faith as a scientist. Again, all available on the DVD and MP3 CD and digital download, available to pre-order now at premier.org.uk/shop. Andy Bannister returned for the second year running to Unbelievable, the conference, this time to talk about Islam and also to tag team with Glenn Scrivener on the 5 hard questions that you voted for. We asked you in a poll to vote for the 5 hard questions you wanted these two to answer at this year's conference. And so they did just that. And here's Andy Bannister answering one of those questions, which was, how can I trust scripture when it's full of myths, contradictions and errors?
So question number 3, how can I trust the Bible? You know, I get this question from a lot. I get it for a lot. I get it from my skeptical friends. I also get it from my Muslim friends. My academic background is engaging with Muslims. My PhD is in Quranic studies, not biblical studies, because I ticked the wrong box on the university application form. But I have a lot of my Muslim friends commonly ask me this question. How can you, Christians, how do you trust the Bible? And in one sense, whether it's coming from atheists or agnostics or people of other faith, I can understand the question. I can really appreciate the question, because the Bible is a very big book. And in places, it can be incredibly baffling. We also have to recognize, of course, that thousands of years stand between us and its time and its culture. So it's not entirely surprising that we should find chunks of it hard to read, and they really stretch us. And I often say to my friends, look, even after decades of being a Christian, there are still parts of the Bible at which I scratch my head and have to work hard to understand. So I can certainly understand and relate to the question. But of course, it's not entirely surprising, though, I like to say to my friends, it's not entirely surprising that the Bible should challenge us. It's not entirely surprising the Bible should challenge us. Why? Because the Bible was written to help us discover, find out about, and enter into a relationship with God, and to grow in that relationship. And of course, if there's no challenge, then there is no relationship. For example, I said to you earlier, it was 21 years ago this year, I asked my wife to marry me. Well, if I decided to replace my wife with a robot who would obey my every command, never question anything, and laugh outrageously at every bad joke I ever come out with, well, life might be easy in some ways, but I wouldn't have a relationship, because a relationship requires challenge. And similarly, if we don't allow the Bible to challenge us and to stretch us, to make us think, even to offend us at times, then in a sense what you're asking for is a God of your own making, not the God of the Bible. In fact, you're not so much after a God as after a dog. He'll just come when you whistle. But you can sometimes even actually, sometimes a little sting in the tail is added to this question, and it goes like this. Well, that's all very well, Andy, but what about all of those errors? What are all those errors in the Bible? And whenever I hear that question, I always like to turn it around and say, well, could you give me an example? Because either one or two things will happen. Either the person you're talking to will give you one, and you can then engage with it, or they'll just have heard sort of generically the Bible has issues, but never actually thought about it. But if they have a particular issue in mind, I like to follow up on it. But one of the questions I like to ask when there is a particular issue is to say to the person, what have you done to try to find the answer to that question? Have you been willing to give the Bible the benefit of the doubt? Or are you using that question you've come up with simply as a kind of roadblock so God can't get any further? Now, does that message of the Bible challenge us? Well, of course, yes, the Bible does challenge us when you take it seriously. Because one thing the Bible does is hold a mirror up to the human condition very, very honestly. And sometimes we don't like that. And so I can understand why people may not want to take the Bible as an authority. But of course, if you're not willing to take the Bible as an authority, that simply raises the question of what is your own authority? Everybody is getting their authority in life somewhere. Everybody has something that is ultimate. What is your ultimate guide to life if it's not the Bible? Now, for many people, it's simply their own choices and their own preferences, their own ideas. But of course, that raises a slightly uncomfortable question of how can you trust yourself, given your own errors, your own inconsistencies, and your own contradictions? Not as easy as you might have thought. Well, one of the reasons, now reframing the question slightly, that I think that people have trouble with the Bible, certainly my Muslim friends often raise this one, I think is knowing where to start. Where do you start if you don't know the Bible, you've never encountered it? You know, there's the old joke about the person who picked up that the best way to read the Bible was to open it at random, and so they tried that. They opened it at random, and the first verse they landed on was Matthew 27, verse 5. Judas went out and hung himself. In panic, they opened it again at random. Second time, they landed on Luke 10, 30. 37, go then and do likewise. That's not the best way to approach the Bible. How should we? Well, I think the best way into the Bible is the Gospels. Those four historical biographies of the life, ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus, the one who claimed not just to be another religious teacher, but God himself, come in the flesh, come in space and time to make himself known to us. You see, the Bible primarily is all about God making himself known. God makes himself known, reveals himself to us in page and in text and in word. But of course, the ultimate word is Jesus himself, God with us. And you discover as you read the Gospels, you discover through the lens of the life of Jesus something very, very important about the Bible. And that's namely that the Bible is not intended primarily to be read as a book of laws and commands and morals. In fact, Jesus reserved an awful lot of criticism for religious leaders who were into that kind of dead moralism. Rather, the Bible is the story of God's intention for humanity, for us to live in relationship with him, the story of what's gone wrong in that relationship, and the story of what God ultimately in Jesus has done to put it right and offer us healing and forgiveness, peace and reconciliation. But the other great reason for starting with the Gospels, as I wrap this answer up, is that there is incredibly powerful evidence that the Gospels were written as historical biographies, either by eyewitnesses to the events or by people drawing heavily on eyewitness testimony. And for sure, there are parts of the Bible that are hard to understand. But in the case of the Gospels, we are on clear historical ground. And if you're a skeptic or a seeker, or a doubter, I think the best entry point to the Bible is to begin with the Gospels And as you work through them, ask yourself the question, who did this Jesus character think that he was, and do I believe him? You know, it's interesting that I've long been fascinated more by the consistency of the Bible than by the difficult passages. You know, we often forget that the Bible is not a book, but the Bible is a library. 66 different books written by 40 different authors over 1,500 years in different countries in several languages, but for all that, it tells a story that is remarkably consistent, startlingly so. Some political leaders can't even be consistent on Twitter from one day to the next. The Bible manages to be consistent over 1,500 years, 40 different authors, 66 different books. And when you approach a book, the key question to ask yourself is, what genre, what type of writing am I dealing with? You see, if I pick up the London A to Z and try to read it as a novel, well, I'll find, my word, the places are so realistic, but the characters are a little bit flat. Try to read the Harry Potter books as a recipe book, and you'll get in a muddle, or maybe a muggle. And see, the jokes are never good, are they? But thank you. So what about the Bible? Well, I want to suggest to you that the Bible is primarily a love story. It's a story of how we've lost that relationship with God for which we were designed, but God has set out to rescue us, win us back into relationship with him. But it's not just a story about God. It's also a story about us, about you and I, about human beings, an open-ended story that asks the question, how will we respond to the God who stepped into space and time and history and reached out to us? Now, as with all of these questions we're looking at this morning, much more that could be said, but a few resources to recommend to you again on the website bit.ly/5hardquestions. Craig Blomberg's book, Can We Still Believe the Bible, digs into a whole range of the latest scholarship on why we can trust the Bible. Richard Borkham's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, fantastic book looking at the evidence for why we can be sure the Gospels were written by drawing on eyewitness testimony. And then two videos for you. Pete Williams from Cambridge University did a wonderful lecture on new evidence that the Gospels are, again, based on eyewitness testimony. And one of our short answer videos at the Solas Center for Public Christianity, all linked on the website, all will take you deeper. So that's the third question, why trust the Bible? Glenn, what's our fourth hard question?
Brilliant.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You're listening to Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio and broadcasting around the world on our podcast too. And this week we've got a special highlights edition of the show from last week's Unbelievable Conference 2018. That was Andy Bannister from the Solas Center for Public Christianity, and went for a little cheeky Chinese with Andy after the conference was over. I was ravenous, along with a friend of ours, David Hutchings, who's also been on the show before. Really good fun, great guys, and watch out for both of them. Always interesting people. Going to be featuring Andy, actually, on this forthcoming Big Conversation series. He's due to have a recording with Peter Singer, the atheist ethicist, on evolution, morality, and do we need God to be good? So look forward to that as part of this Big Conversation series coming up. But you can also watch Andy and Glenn answer the rest of those questions that were part of that Five Hard Questions seminar that they were responding to on the Unbelievable Conference DVD, MP3 CD, and digital download. Again, go to the website in order to pre-order it if you'd like it, premier.org.uk/shop. Well, Ken Samples was one of three scholars, including Hugh Ross and Fuzz Rana from Reasons to Believe, at our conference this year. They were our conference partners, and they made a week of it, actually, with other friends from Reasons to Believe as they toured the UK. And indeed, I had them come into the studio last week. Hugh Ross, an astrophysicist, recorded a great edition of Unbelievable with atheist scientist Peter Atkins, and you'll be able to hear that on next week's programme. So that's something to look forward to for next week. But right now, here's Ken Samples in one of his sessions on other religions, titled If Krishna and Buddha Met Christ.
So that first question, why can't all the world's religions be true? Our answer is common sense, logic, and the scripture tells us all religions can't be true. How about the second question? Isn't Jesus just another religious leader? I mean, you've got 11 alternative non-Christians religions. You got Buddha, you've got Krishna, you've got Confucius, you've got Lao Tzu, on and on and on, Zoroaster. What makes Jesus so unique? If we were to take Matthew 16 and kind of put it in a modern context, it might read this way. Who do the world's religions say the Son of Man is? Well, the Buddhists say a bodhisattva. The Hindus say an avatar, and the Muslims say one of the prophets of Allah. But what about you, he asks. Who do you say I am? The historic Orthodox Christians answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. The issue of the truth of Christianity in light of other religions is very profound. I'm told that London may be the most diverse religious city in the world. Although I'll tell you, Los Angeles would be a competition. And you know what? If I were living 50 years ago and I wanted to talk to a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Muslim, I'd have to go overseas. But you know probably better than I that today we live with such religious diversity. Now, I think that's a great thing because I used to worry, how can we get the gospel to people who've never heard it? Well, today we don't have much of a problem because we all live together. The gospel gives us an opportunity to communicate. Now, this question of isn't Jesus just another religious leader? Well, one of the people that I enjoy most reading is C.S. Lewis. Going up to the Kilns was quite exciting for me to see where Lewis is buried. Was really quite an experience for me. The first Christian book I ever read in my life. I was raised a nominal Catholic. I was a sophomore in college, and my sister had become a Christian. She gave me Mere Christianity, and I began reading it. The first thought was, I never thought a Christian could be that careful and thoughtful. I thought religious people were feelers, not thinkers. Well, C.S. Lewis is a thinker, and we should be thinkers. I like feelers. I like warm Christian people, but I also like careful Christian people. Well, Lewis has an argument in Mere Christianity. In Latin, we call it aut Deus, aut malus homo, either God or a bad man. Now, C.S. Lewis was an expert on mythology, right? He's an English scholar studying medieval and Renaissance literature. He spent his whole life reading different myths. And he says, you know, when I open up the Gospels, I know one thing. They're not mythical. This is not a mythical genre. So now we are stuck. What do we do with Jesus, who as a first century Jew, I mean, according to Judaism, human beings aren't supposed to go around telling other people that they're God and letting them worship them. Yahweh is God and God alone. But Lewis says, we got a real challenge here. Since the Gospels are not myths, since they are a historical narrative, what do we do with the divinity of Jesus? Now, I think Jesus claims to be God in a number of ways. He says, I and the Father, we are one. He says he has this contentious debate with some of the Jewish religious leaders. They become frustrated with him and they say, who are you? And he says, he reaches into the Old Testament and takes the most sacred name of God and applies it to himself. He says, before Abraham came into existence, I am. And if you look at Isaiah 45 through 48, Yahweh has a name for himself. He calls himself, I am or I am he. It may also be echoing Exodus, Moses before the burning bush, I am. And what do the religious leaders do when they hear that name, I am? They pick up stones to stone him. But I want to also illustrate that Jesus views himself as God by the prerogatives. That is, he claims to do the things that only God can do. He claims to be able to forgive sins. Mark 2:5, when Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralyzed man, son, your sins are forgiven. And there's a Jewish fellow sitting there, and he stands up and says, but who can forgive sins but God alone? Exactly. Jesus claims to do the things only God can do. Accepting worship. No human being should ever accept worship. Paul and Barnabas are witnessing to the pagans, and they want to worship them, and they say, no, don't worship us. Worship God alone. But you know what? Jesus doesn't have problems people worshiping him. Matthew 28:17, when they saw Jesus, they worshiped him, and he didn't rebuke them. He says he can answer prayer. John 14:14, you may ask me anything in my name, and I'll do it. How is that possible? He claims to raise the dead, for just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whomever he gives it to. And then finally, Jesus claims to judge humanity, John 5:22. The Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the Son. All of this leads us to indicate that Jesus not only makes divine claims, he not only applies divine titles to himself, Son of God and Son of Man are both divine titles. But he claims to be able to act as if he is Yahweh, that he is an extension of Yahweh himself. Forgive sin, receive worship, answer prayer, raise the dead, judge humanity. So let's put it into a logical argument, right? A logical argument is really a very simple thing. You make a claim, and then you back it up. You have an opinion, and you support it. So the first two premises are the support, the conclusion is the claim. Premise one, whoever does the things that only God can do is God. Premise two, Jesus does the things that only God can do. Conclusion, therefore Jesus is God.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You're listening to Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio and available around the world at our website as a podcast, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. This week, playing highlights from Unbelievable the Conference 2018, Just Ask. And you've only heard a tiny amount, really, of what happened on the day in London. There were loads more sessions on reaching young people, how to be an online evangelist and not suck, is God behind human biology, the improbable planet, how Earth gives evidence for heaven, and much more besides. 14 plus hours of audio and DVD available if you pre-order the MP3 CD and DVD or the digital download from our webpage, premier.org.uk/shop. If you weren't there, or even if you were there, but you just couldn't get to all the seminars, then why not go and order it? premier.org.uk/shop. Well, in the final section of today's show, shortly, we'll hear some excerpts from the final Q&A as the audience got involved to ask their burning questions of a whole panel of our speakers. That's coming up shortly.
Hello and welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading skeptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable show with me, Justin Brierley, foregoing our usual debate format to hear some highlights from last week's Unbelievable the Conference 2018. We will be back to our usual format next week when astrophysicist Hugh Ross faces off against atheist chemist Peter Atkins as they debate the origins of the laws of nature. That was a really fun debate to chair. You'll be hearing that on next week's show. And then straight after that, the following week, the 9th of June, we'll be into the first of our big conversation shows. Jordan B. Peterson and Susan Blackmore will be facing off against each other. Jordan B. Peterson, something of a cultural phenomenon since he's risen to great heights in the last 18 months or so. And he'll be in conversation with atheist Susan Blackmore on the psychology of religion and whether we need God to make sense of life. Be sure to register at the Big Conversation website to be the first to watch that show when they drop and for exclusive content as well. And also do go and check out the promo video, which is available at the website too. That's at thebigconversation.show. Straight after Unbelievable today at 4 p.m. on The Profile, comedian Andy Kind is in conversation with Sam Hales. Andy Kind, genuinely funny guy. I know him quite well, and it's well worth downloading that if you can. The Profile has its own podcast as well from Premier. So go and check that out wherever you get your podcast from. But we're finishing today's edition of Unbelievable with some selected excerpts from the questions that the 600-strong audience asked at the end of Unbelievable Conference 2018. So I was joined on stage by Hugh Ross, Ken Samples, Fuzz Rana, Ruth Jackson, Glenn Scrivener, Sharon Dirks, and Andy Bannister to take some of those questions. Here's some of what you asked on the day.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Yeah, hi. What would Christ say to the youth
our children. What would Christ say about homosexuality?
Ooh, okay. The hot potato comes out immediately. All right. So particularly, what would Christ say to our youth and young people about homosexuality? Okay, so was that Ruth and Glenn that you were asking that of?
Jesus loves gay people, number one, and number two, and number three, and number four. And number five, six, seven are things about a beautiful vision for sex and sexuality that Christians have. I think the Bible really is a romance. It really is about the marriage of heaven and earth. You know, we've seen a royal marriage today, and I think the Bible really is about a royal marriage. It really is about heaven wanting to unite to earth, this different yet equal union that's going to be fruitful and multiplying. And I think therefore Christians have this odd and different view of sex and sexuality to the surrounding culture. And my number one message to gay people is, come to Jesus, let me show you a beautiful love story. And then down the track, let's talk about how that plays out in real life and how that plays out in terms of faithful marriages of man and woman for life. That's what I believe in. I think that's the biblical teaching on it. I think that's important to teach, but I think the most important thing to teach is the love story that we are inviting people into. And then it's not just gay people that have discipleship issues once they come to Christ. You know, I've got huge discipleship issues as a guy who I guess might identify as straight. I'm not sure. You know, I'm married to a woman. I'm very happy with that. But, you know, I've got all sorts of discipleship issues. Everyone's got all sorts of discipleship issues. I think the number one thing to do is to preach the Christian love story and then deal with the discipleship issues as we go.
So I find this question come up a lot, and we talked about this a little bit in our session, that young people are never asking these questions in a vacuum. It's never, ever an intellectual question. So what I get a lot is, why does God hate my gay friend? There's such a personal question in that. And obviously the answer is, of course he doesn't hate your gay friend. He loves them more than you could possibly imagine. And so I think that one of the things we need to do is talk about identity. And I think the fact that they've even called them gay friend, I think, is sometimes unhelpful. They wouldn't introduce you as their straight friend. You're just their friend. And so partly we need to break down that identity issue, which is really difficult because for a gay person, their identity is so tied up in their homosexuality. But actually, first and foremost, they are a beloved child of God. You know, God sings over them. He rejoices over them with singing. He adores them. He doesn't look at them and see their homosexuality. He looks at them and sees a beloved child of God. The other thing I think we really need to do in the church is get a better theology of singleness. Why is singleness looked at as a second-rate alternative? I think there's a real hierarchy in the church of, if you're married with kids, then you've properly made it. If you're married, then you're there. If you're single, then you've probably got some issues. And that's absolutely not true. Just look at the Bible, for goodness sake. And so we've got to get a better theology of singleness, particularly in our youth ministry. I was talking to Catherine Hill a little bit about this. We've for some reason in our church, we've got this thing where, you know, you're kind of broken until you get married. And then when you get married, it's going to be this amazing thing. And for a start, that's such an unhealthy view of marriage, because then you get into marriage and you think that it's going to be phenomenal. But actually, you're bringing all your baggage. They're bringing all their baggage. It's not going to be phenomenal. Like, it will be down the line, but you've got an awful lot of kind of baggage to deal with. And I think we need to get a better theology of singleness and a better theology of identity within the church. And that's incredibly difficult if someone doesn't know God. I think we need to, the first and foremost, we need to introduce people to God and introduce people to his love and the fact that he loves them unconditionally. So for me, an absolute microcosm of the whole Bible is the prodigal son, where the father just does everything he can to run to the son. And that's what I would focus on, not the other questions. That's a bit of a...
Thank you. No, I think it was really helpful. Let's have some more hands and see who else would
like
to ask
a question. Over here.
Thank you. Billy Graham said once, he's not surprised if there is a life on another planet. I want to ask, how would Adam and Eve feel if there is a life on another planet?
Okay. Thank you. Great question. Well, let's go to Hugh, first of all, for this. What would Adam and Eve make of it if it turned out there was life on other planets? Do you think there's life on other planets, Hugh? What do you think?
Well, I've been on record since the 1980s. We will find the remains of life on virtually every solar system body, simply because of how abundant and diverse life is here on planet Earth. I mean, we know that there's 20,000 kilograms of Earth soil in every 100 square kilometers of the moon. And one ton of Earth soil has 100 quadrillion microbes in it. So we will find the remains of life on other planets.
Planets that have... Is that because we've sort of sent it out from our...
Yeah, because when a meteor hits the Earth, it exports the soil.
So our microbes will have infected other solar systems eventually.
No, it will not infect other solar systems, only our solar system.
I see. But do you think life could arise on other planets in the universe?
All the observational evidence tells us that the universe is hostile for life except for our planet Earth. Now, from a biblical perspective, you've got options. Because the Bible doesn't rule out the possibility of God creating life on other planets. He may have done that. He may have constrained it to just this planet. So it's a theological debate. From a scientific perspective, the science seems to be leaning towards us being unique.
Being unique. That's very interesting. Ken, did you want to...
You know, it's interesting that Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century asked that question. So it's not just in our modern world where people have asked those questions. Thomas thought there could be life on other planets. It does raise a question about the uniqueness of the visited planet in terms of the incarnation. But Christians have been asking those questions for a long time.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's have another question from the audience. There's someone down here at the front who's going to ask, and then we'll go to another at the side. Yes.
Thank you very much. And thanks for a great conference. We've really enjoyed it. So my question is really about the science and scripture one. What is your take on Adam and Eve? They've just been mentioned. Did our life as human beings start with literally Adam and Eve?
Did life start with Adam and Eve?
Did we as human beings, do we come from one pair of ancestors called Adam and Eve, as the Bible says?
Pass this to Fuzz. This is Fuzz's speciality here.
Yeah, well, our position at Reasons to Believe was there was a historical Adam and Eve that were the first progenitors of all humanity, and I think that's the what seems to be the traditional historical understanding from a Christian perspective of human origins. And you know, it's interesting because there's some provocative evidence that suggests that this view has credibility. For example, when we look at the genetic variability of people around the world using mitochondrial DNA as a genetic marker, we do trace an origin back to a single ancestral sequence that's been dubbed mitochondrial Eve that some anthropologists believe was an actual single female individual. And you can see a corresponding pattern with Y-chromosomal DNA data where the genetic variation in Y-chromosomal DNA indicates Every man comes from a single ancestral sequence dubbed Y-chromosome Adam in the scientific literature. Again, likely corresponds to a single male individual. And it looks as if mitochondrial Eve, and Y-chromosomal Adam coexisted at the same time. Now, you'll hear people in the quote-unquote mainstream scientific community argue against the idea that there was a primordial pair. They would argue when you look at the genetic variability of humanity, it looks like it's too extensive to come from two individuals. So they would acknowledge mitochondrial Eve and Y-chromosomal Adam, they would have said there are many Eves, there are many Adams. We just happen to come from that one lucky mother, the one lucky father. But when you look at the way in which the estimates are developed for what the population size was from genetic variability, those methods actually are suspect in terms of the way they perform. You can actually show that those methods that are used to calculate population sizes are unreliable. And we document that in Who is Adam and some articles on our website pointing out the original scientific literature where those studies demonstrate that the unreliability of the population size estimates. So when we look at the whole package, it really does look like, as Genesis 3:20 said, Adam named his wife Eve. She would be the mother of every living person. That passage is scientifically credible.
Thank you very much. That's a lot of information in a very short time, but it's really helpful. Okay, we've got another question on this side. Someone's got the mic, I think. Go ahead.
Yes, I've got the mic. I'd like to ask, what is dark matter and why does it matter?
Well,
What is dark matter and why does it matter? Okay. Hugh, I'm going to limit you to 1 minute, all right?
Okay. Yeah. Dark matter is exotic dark matter. That was the old term. It's basically matter that doesn't interact well with light. We know it makes up 23% of all the stuff of the universe, and we need that dark matter because it stabilizes the dynamics of galaxies in a way that makes life possible. So without that dark matter, the galaxies would fall apart and life would be impossible. And yeah, that dark matter must be exquisitely fine-tuned. It needs to be fine-tuned in a very exquisite degree in order for light to be possible. So thank God for dark matter.
Okay.
We have a question from right at the very back.
Great, great. Yeah. I wanted to come to the back. Let's have one from the back. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for this great conference.
You're welcome.
We see that there is interdenominational presence, which is very good. And our Lord Jesus Christ said, unless you are united, the people outside would not know that we are one. So the problem, we are here for our children and to preach for others. My older son challenged me and told me, look, there is 20,000 denominations of Christianity, and everyone say I am right, and the rest are wrong. So your Christianity is not right. So how can we be united on a level of children, as
Great.
Jesus said?
Great question. Thank you very much. Ken, do you want to try and tackle this one? If we're supposed to be united, how come there are 20,000 of us, and can we all be right at the same time?
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that question. I think that Christians should seek unity wherever they can find it. I think, however, when we look at conservative Christendom, Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestants, there's so much we agree upon found in the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed. That's a very large slice of historic Christianity. Moreover, C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, if you read the preface, he has his idea of mere Christianity. And as a great storyteller, Lewis says, think of Christendom as a large mansion. In my father's house, there are many mansions or many rooms. And Lewis talks about each of the branches of Christendom, the denominations within Protestantism have their own rooms. And Christians gravitate toward one of those rooms. But it's in the hallway that there's mere Christianity. And Lewis says things like this: be charitable to other people who haven't yet decided what room they belong to. He also says, don't talk about the differences in Christianity unless everybody in the room already believes that Jesus is the Son of God. I think one of the apologetic challenges today is the appearance of a lack of unity. I think that most Christian groups have deep common ground, but I think we need to be encouraged to look at what we have, an affirmation of the Trinity, the two natures of Christ, Jesus' death on the cross, his resurrection. There is a lot of unity that we have, but we need more.
Okay, thank you very much. Great, another question perhaps from this side of the audience. There's a gentleman with his hand up there, and then we'll come again to here, and maybe we'll get to the back again before we have to wrap up. Go ahead.
Hi, how do I answer someone who thinks, who has a question, how could a God send people to hell? And that comes from, technically speaking, we're all sinners, but then we're sinners because of someone else's choice. Mm. So it doesn't sound very
fair. Were you in the very first seminar in here in the morning? Because that question did actually come up
okay,
then.
Okay, I wasn't there.
Okay, well...
And if I could ask a second question, do you think there are proportionate levels of punishment in hell?
Okay.
So, for example...
Questions around hell. Glenn, you... were addressing this very question this morning, weren't you?
Yeah, a great book on that to follow up is Joshua Ryan Butler's The Skeletons in God's Closet, and he talks about hell, judgment, and holy war. And he says, we tend to think of these as the issues that we put in the closet and hope nobody looks. But he opens up the closet and he looks in and he says, you know, by the end of this, I want you punching the air for these biblical truths. And you think that's a really tall order, but he manages it in that book. And one of the things he says is that in this cosmic romance that we're talking about, heaven comes to earth and says, will you marry me? And God doesn't beat us over the head and drag us back to his cave. That's not the marriage proposal. Nor does he say, marry me or I punish you forever. He says, marry me or go your own way. And unfortunately, that's what hell is. Hell is this outer darkness with the weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth that is apart from this cosmic romance. But Joshua Ryan Butler says, look, the Bible is a heaven and earth book. You look up the phrase heaven and earth and you find hundreds of occurrences. You look up the phrase heaven and hell, you find zero occurrences. It's not a heaven and hell book. It's a heaven and earth book. And if you resist that union, then there is the outer darkness and there is a place called that. And Jesus does talk about degrees of it. He does in many of his parables, and I take those, you know, to that degree, I take those literally in that there are degrees of it. But the headline story is the marriage of heaven and earth, and heaven comes to earth and says, will you marry me? There is this thing that's called going your own way. It's a hell of a life. You don't want that. But the headline story is heaven and earth and that cosmic romance.
Do you want to add to that?
Can I just add something? So I think Glenn's exactly right. It's kind of our choice. And so I think the way it's framed, does God send people to hell? I think that's unhelpful. Actually, no, we choose hell if we choose to reject God. But I think what's absolutely significant and what we have to hammer home is that that's not the only choice available to us. And so where we have chosen hell naturally, there was someone else's choice involved, which is Jesus's. And we see in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, not my will, but yours be done. And he chooses to go to hell so we don't have to. And actually, that's the message of the gospel. And that's what we need to put forward, is that he's gone to hell so we don't have to. So it's not the only choice. We've got an alternative.
I tried to address this a little bit in my own book. And one way that I think is sometimes helpful to explain to a skeptic is, if there was a place where Jesus is king of the whole world, would you want to be there? Because actually, I don't think everyone does want to be there. But that's what heaven is. It's not some retirement party in the sky with endless golf. It's a place where Jesus is king forever. And if that's not what someone wants, then God isn't going to force it on them, in my view. So I think it's really important to understand firstly what heaven is, because that might inform us about what hell actually is as well. Anyway, great questions. Thank you very much. So where did we... We got there, didn't we? We're going to go over here again for the next question, and then we'll see. And then if someone can rush to the back for any more questions from the back, we might just have time for one more at the back as well. Go ahead, sir.
My question is perhaps about the cultural apathy, particularly in the UK, towards any religion of any kind. Basically, religion, is the response I get. These sorts of questions we've been crunching are quite defensive. Mm. So I was wondering, how much permission and license do we have to go on the offensive, and how do we do that?
How do we not simply react to the objections people have? How do we put it out there? Do you want to start us off, Sharon, with this one? Go ahead.
Thank you for the question, and it sounds like you really, you know, what I'm getting from the way you're describing is just your heart for your friends and your desire to reach them, and I think God sees that and knows that and wants to help you in that. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about at the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, which really originates with Michael Ramsden, who is a brilliant apologist, is the importance of learning to ask questions and ask good questions. So when someone comes to us with a question, which hopefully they have asked maybe because they've seen something different about the way we live and, you know, the need to be set apart and distinctive and in the world but not of the world and all of that. When someone comes to us with a question, our first job is to ask them a question back. and probably another one and another one. And I think it was Francis Schaeffer that if he had an hour with a person, he would spend 55 minutes asking questions and 5 minutes actually responding, because then you really get to the heart of the question and get to really the core issue. Also, it turns it into a dialogue rather than a monologue from us. And I get what you say about the need to be on the offensive, but I think what we really need to do is engage people in conversations so that there is a conversation that takes place that then hopefully, and often we see on university campuses and schools that it's these conversations that during it the person becomes more open, and actually then there's room not just to talk about their particular question but eventually to get to the gospel of Jesus Christ as well. So I would encourage you, rather than thinking about being on the offensive, actually learning to ask good questions and asking the Holy Spirit for wisdom, reading good books for wisdom in that as well.
Did anyone else want to chip in on that one? I think, Andy, yep, go ahead.
Yeah, just a very quick addition to that. You definitely deserve an award for holding your hand up for quite that. quite that long without falling off. Yeah, just to add to what Sharon said, I also think the question-asking approach can be really, really helpful with people who self-describe or don't even self-describe as apathetic, agnostic, and all of those things. Because one of the things I'm conscious at a conference like this is that, you know, we've done a lot of presentation and our different various speakers here on, you know, if somebody asks this question, this is how you engage. And often what I hear, and maybe some of you are sitting out here thinking this evening, thinking, well, I wish my friends were asking difficult questions, but they're just not. They're just sitting there like a blancmange going, so what do I do? Well, that's where questions ride to the rescue as well, because I think we can learn to ask provoking questions. As you get to know your friends, find out what interests them. What are they passionate about? You know, those who listen to the show frequently, you know, I mean, Justin and I, you've had me on a few times to do the human rights topic with various people, because that's a wonderful one. If I discover someone's into social justice and human rights, I'm in like a shot.
And can I just also say, Andy will be on this big conversation series with none other than Peter Singer, who's a well-known atheist ethicist debating just these kinds of issues. So
an atheist ethicist.
An atheist ethicist.
Yeah, that's very good. Very quickly, so like the human rights question. You can ask somebody, obviously you seem very passionate about justice. Well, yes, I am. That's really interesting. Why do you think it matters? In fact, you're nodding. I mean, you can see where those questions begin to take you. And the book that I think really helps you with this, Tim Keller's, one of his, I'd say his most recent, he writes a book before breakfast, isn't he? One of his many, many, many books, Making Sense of God, that came out a couple of years ago, I think offers a number of ways you can do that around different topics. And I think look for ways in where you can begin they may not be God-type conversations, but they're little seeds that will grow into God-type conversations. But exactly as Sharon said, questions get you so far in these things.
Thank you so much. We just have time for one more. Was there a question from the back? Okay, we've got someone there, yes, go ahead. Final question, the floor is yours.
Yes, hi, thank you very much. Last night I was with an atheist friend. Ooh. Who has for a couple of years been exploring who Jesus is and comes around and secretly wants to do a Bible study with me.
And, it's like Nicodemus and Jesus, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
Meeting in the night.
But she has this image to maintain that she's an atheist. Before family and other friends. But last night we were doing an art project together, which is a stretch for me because I'm not very artistic. But over that, we had conversation, and she asked why it is through the centuries that the Jewish people have been so hated and disliked. And that really stopped me in my tracks because I said, well, it's a complicated answer, and I need more time. And so we just got to talk about, her perspective on how they've suffered. But I wanted to know, I told her I would come back to her, I wanted to know how you would answer it.
Okay. Who wants to tackle this one? Because I have no idea who should go for this one.
I'll take a stab at it.
Go ahead, Hugh. Take a stab at this one.
Okay. Take a look at the book of Ezekiel, especially Ezekiel 32 through 40. It speaks about the second return of the Jews to the land of Israel and how after a long period of persecution by the nations, God would show his love to the Jews again. But he would do it in such a way as to get the attention of the Gentiles. He says, I'm doing this so that the Gentiles will know that I am God and the way I'm supernaturally blessing you. So you'll see statements in those chapters in Ezekiel how God would fight for them like he did in the past. He would perform miracles for them. Their land would become wealthy and rich. and would be the envy of the nations of the world. And you know, the fact that we're seeing that take place today is getting the attention of the Gentiles. So God is using his love poured upon the Jews today as a way of communicating to the Gentiles, I love all peoples on the face of the earth, and my goal is to redeem all. And keep in mind, you got that promise in Zechariah 13, a day will come when a third of all the Jews will recognize the one that they have pierced and become followers of the Messiah.
Interesting. Glenn, did you want to add something to that?
So Galatians talks about the offspring of Abraham, and if you go back to Genesis chapter 15, it talks about Abraham and his offspring will go down into Egypt and come out with great glory and goodness, and it's this idea that the seed of Abraham, the offspring of Abraham, will go on this cross and resurrection journey. And you ask, well, who is the offspring of Abraham? Well, I guess by the flesh, it's the Jews. Singularly, it's Christ, down into death and then raised again. And then spiritually, spiritually it's the church engrafted into Christ. And just look historically at what has happened. Why do we have Jewish friends? Why is there this, why has God preserved a people according to the flesh called the Jews? I don't know that I have any Hittite friends. I don't know that I have any Philistine friends. I don't know that I have any Moabite friends. I've got Jewish friends. Isn't that extraordinary? And yet, so what do we see? We see the glory of God preserving a people through incredible suffering. And in the world, there is this testimony to the way of Christ, actually, suffering and glory. And in the ethnic people of Israel, I think we see this. I think spiritually also, the church, there is no more persecuted group on earth than Christians, not so much in this country, but globally. But again, you know, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. There is this shape to the seed of Abraham in the world. Look at the Jews, look at the church, and you're getting an image, really, of Christ. This is the true seed of Abraham. So I would just, you know, press into that. Isn't it interesting that there is this example of suffering and glory, and maybe it's pointing to Christ?
I saw an article recently in World Magazine that said the fastest growing segment within Judaism is Messianic Judaism.
Interesting. Shall we give a round of applause for our panel? Well, that was where our conference ended, but there was much more that got asked in that Q&A section. You just heard some selected excerpts from it. And indeed, you can book for next year's conference at the super early bird half price rate right now if you go to premier.org.uk/justask. Yes, we've still got our old conference website up there, but we've actually got links to the ticketing for 2019. Saturday the 20th of July is the date that we've ring-fenced for next year's conference, and you can get that super early bird rate if you go along there now and book your tickets. If you know you want to be there, premier.org.uk/justask to get the super early bird rate. But if you want this year's conference on DVD, MP3 CD and digital download, you can get the whole of the seminars, all of the audio and video, wherever you are in the world. Pre-order now at premier.org.uk/shop. It's been great fun having you on the programme with me today. Hope you can come back again at the same time next week. Let me tell you what's coming up then.
You're unbelievable.
Christian astrophysicist Hugh Ross and atheist scientist Peter Atkins will be debating the origins of the laws of nature. Peter says that nothing rolled over into something. Hugh says God was behind it. They have a fantastic discussion on next week's show. Hope you can be there for it too. Until then, have a great week. The Profile's here next. You've been listening to The Unbelievable Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.